This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. At one time, midwives were part of pregnancy and birth in America until there was a shift to professionalized medicine when doctors took the lead in obstetric care. Midwifery or midwifery is slowly being embraced again, and a new report in PLOS One, a peer-reviewed scientific journal, finds the U.S. states that give midwives a bigger role in patient care see better health outcomes for mothers and babies. Coming up, we'll talk with ProPublica reporter Nina Martin, who reported on this story, and we'll hear from an obstetrician at the who is a medical director of obstetrics at the Vidone Birth Center at Yale New Haven Hospital, St. Raphael. First, Eastern Connecticut makes up a region of 42 towns. A new report looks at the outcomes for 224,000 women and girls who live in this part of the state. And you can join the conversation too, 860-275-7266. You can email Where We Live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome into the studio Miriam Alahi, President and CEO of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut. They're the ones that worked on this report, also a member of the Board of Connecticut Public. Miriam, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Also in studio with us is a trustee of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut, Chief Lynn Malerba of the Mohegan Tribe. She also has a doctorate in nursing. Welcome to the show, Chief Malerba.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us this morning.
A very in-depth report, Miriam. Let's start with why your organization commissioned this report, and what did you look at specifically?
Thank you. Well, for years, we've been gathering data and learning through anecdotal stories from so many of our grantees about how women and girls prosper in our region, what the needs are, what the challenges are, and how we can do better. And we felt that it was really important to dig deeper. There hadn't really been a report done in our region, the eastern third of Connecticut, that looked at, you know, where we are, where women and girls are in terms of education, economic security, health, welfare, secure safety, personal safety. And we thought that it would inform our grant making to be much more strategic. It would help philanthropists in the region, policymakers, and nonprofit leaders get a better sense of what works, what the challenges are, and where we can come together to bring about change for the better.
Tell us about the women and girls who live in Eastern Connecticut. I mentioned at the top of the show this is a part of the state that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Thank you for asking. So we learned a lot through this report. For example, we learned that we have, and it's not strange and it's not just unique to this region, but we have an aging population of 65 and over of women, and that elder care is an issue and it's not being addressed as vociferously as it should be. Education is always something that provides a leg up, as we know, in our communities. And we learned that one in five women in Willimantic and New London don't have a high school diploma. And we know how that skews opportunities for the future. Of course, when you dig deeper into women of color, this becomes even a deeper concern. The opioid crisis is one of our concerns across Connecticut, and in Eastern Connecticut, it's clearly an issue of great concern. Mental health is an area that we're recommending greater focus. We learned that women, younger women, millennials, have four times more chances of being depressed than men of the same age. Violence against women is a major public health issue, and we have terrific women's shelters and prevention nonprofits working in the region, but they're still not reaching out as effectively as they would if they had more capacity and funding. So as we gathered the data and the findings, what we're trying to do is to build communities, to have conversations and build a momentum, talk with policymakers, and really have conversations around how we go about changing social norms, how we go about changing policies, so that instead of changing one life at a time, we can change the situation for larger communities at a time.
We hear so often, Miriam, that resources are stretched in Connecticut, and the challenges and that you have mentioned in Eastern Connecticut can also be found in other parts of the state. So what are the best ways to get a further reach in that particular 42-town region of Eastern Connecticut? What are some, I know you have this report and you've talked about it with your stakeholders, but what are the next steps? So how do you, I guess, expand that reach so these different issues that can be addressed in a sufficient way?
First of all, I think we all need to come to the table and agree that investing in our women and children is investing in our future. So once we have that agreement, then it makes it much easier to discuss which kind of policies we should be investing in, because we're looking forward and ensuring that in 10, 20 years, we will benefit from this investment today. Second, we are working together collaboratively with other community foundations, other funders, and women's groups to address our policymakers at the Capitol, so that this is not intended to be one region over another. It's intended to be all of us do better when our women and girls get the kind of attention that they need.
This is Where We Live. You're listening to Maryam Alahi, President and CEO of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut. The organization just released a report on the status of women and girls in Eastern Connecticut. And also in studio with me is Chief Lynn Malerba of the Mohegan Tribe. She's a trustee of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut, has a doctorate in nursing. We heard Maryam mention a couple of issues related to health care. From your background in the health field, what stands out to you?
What stands out to me especially is the fact that we need to think about health in a very holistic way. And you can imagine I would say that coming from a Native tribe. The other thing that I think is so important is the fact that health is political. And one of the quotes that I love is, the primary determinants of disease are mainly economic and social, and therefore its remedies must also be economic and social. Medicine and politics cannot and should not be kept apart. So if we think about how we're going to improve the health status of women and girls, we have to think about how we have a cohesive healthcare policy. It makes no sense that it, depending on where you live, depends on what your health status is, and also whether or not you're employed makes a difference about what your personal health status is. And my attitude is that healthcare is a right, it's a human right. And we need to think about how we take care of all of our people in a way that is nurturing, it's cohesive, and it makes sense in terms of policy. So when I think about the Community Foundation, I think what they talk about is the fact that, you know, we need to promote individual health. And we need to promote individual economic security. We know that if you have poor health, it's a barrier to your employment. And so that affects your economic security. We need to increase food security. We need to think about how we access healthcare and human services. We need to think about the things that are barriers for people. What about transportation? Transportation is a huge barrier to healthcare. If you don't have transportation, or if you're working and you're unable to access healthcare because of the timing of your scheduled shift, that's a problem. We also need to think about how our relationship to the environment and perhaps our healthy environment, you know, protects our health or harms our health. As I've worked throughout Indian country, even though Indian lands are about 4% of the United States, 24% of all the Superfund sites are on Indian lands. How do those toxins affect the next generations in terms of epigenetics? We need to really think about how our policy affects the health of women and girls in our United States, but in particularly in southeastern Connecticut, because that's where I live, that's where our tribe has always been, and we, you know, help to contribute to some of the various not-for-profits, because we believe that it's our job and our duty to help everyone achieve a better lifestyle and quality of life.
This report looks again at the status of women and girls. Something in the report that is surprising: we've heard that birth rates among teenagers has gone down, but in some eastern Connecticut cities, the birth rate is higher than other parts of the state, Mary?
Yeah, I mean, it all goes back to access to education and engaging with our younger girls through various programs that we actually have funded to make sure that they are they are taking care of themselves and that they have opportunities for better health options and healthier options. So that's something that we're very engaged in, and it's obviously something that we're concerned about.
You mentioned earlier also among mental health issues, significantly higher rates of depression among women students than male students. Mental health, that's something that is being talked about nationwide in the last few weeks. What is working in terms of what you're seeing? Because again, Eastern Connecticut is a large region. What's working and how can that be replicated in other parts of that region, Chief Malerba?
I think one of the most important things is to really have a conversation with our communities, because the solutions to mental health and the solutions to depression and any of the challenges that we're facing are going to come from our community. So we need to understand our community, and I think that that's why this study is so important, because it gives us a baseline to work from, and it helps us understand where we're at today, because you can't articulate where you want to end up unless you understand what your baseline is. And once we have those conversations and we really understand what our children and our women are facing in our community, then I think we can develop those solutions in conjunction and in collaboration with the people who are most affected, because it's not a top-down approach. It's got to be a bottom-up approach. So I think that those conversations are going to be very helpful in helping us strategize and also gather the information that we need to then collaborate with the other agencies throughout Southeastern Connecticut so that we have a cohesive approach to how we're going to really realize some gains here.
I want to go back to Maryam Alahi, President and CEO of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut. Let's talk about the poverty in that region. 1 in 10 households under the poverty line. Also, many women, families living in this condition called ALICE. Can you tell us what ALICE stands for and a little bit further on the challenges for women and families?
Yes. ALICE is actually, it's an acronym that the United Way put together some years ago that is based on the report that they did. It's about asset-limited income families and women, in particular, in that part of our region. And it looked at families where they are basically what we refer to as the working poor. People have jobs that allow them to basically just survive on the brink. So a lost paycheck, a health emergency, and need for a child at school, transportation costs, breakdown in the car, whatever along these lines could happen, the family would go into debt. And this is of great concern because they are just surviving on the brink. So when we talk, all of these issues are connected. When we talk about the importance of access to education for everyone and the importance of getting a high school diploma, it is because there's evidence that once young people have access to a college diploma, to a high school diploma, they can then get better jobs and have access to employment and rise. When we look at the data, the differential between girls and boys, women and men, having access to STEM jobs, for example, it is all connected to the fact that their educational opportunities were skewed in different ways. And from early on, whatever job you have at the early part of your career, as we know, it impacts your move up in the career line, and therefore it impacts the family income. So at the end of the day, what we come away with is the conclusion that when women and girls do better, the families do better and the community does better. And part of our commitment to convey to policymakers is that when we invest in opportunities for women and girls, we make sure that the communities in our state do better.
You know, it's interesting when we're talking about working families and how sometimes they're just one paycheck away from reaching a crisis point. Working families who need child care, and we know child care costs are exorbitant in the state. Your report finds $15,000 a year. At the same time, the state is cutting back on the subsidies to help some of these families with child care. Chief Malerba, I mean, how do we get past that, helping people even get to their job because they need to find a place for their child to be during the day?
And that is really a challenge for us. We are very fortunate at Mohegan because we do operate a child care center and we subsidize that center. So I think employers need to be part of the solution to that problem. And it's not just good childcare. It's access to good childcare. But what if your child is sick and you have to take a day off from work, or there is a snow day or a teacher development day? All of those things factor into your employment. And I think we need to make sure that our employment policies and our employer policies support families for doing that, and that there's more flexibility in their scheduling and their time at work so that they're able to fulfill their commitment to their employer, but also not be so stressed out about how their child is going to be cared for on those days that they put their employment in jeopardy for that reason.
We were talking about the workforce and employers. I'm curious about what the pay gap looks like, Miriam, for women in this part of the region.
Yes, what we found is it's actually not dissimilar to other parts of the region. It's women get paid about 70 cents to a dollar than men do. And when you dig deeper, when you talk about women of color, it's even the disparities are even deeper. And then again, it goes back to the conversation we had on education.
Education, the disparities among the number of women who end up with advanced degrees or that are even involved in the STEM fields. Can we talk a little bit more about what your data found?
Yes. We find that actually there's there is more opportunities for girls to move in the area of STEM, and that's very hopeful. We've been in some of the organizations that we support are encouraging girls to move into STEM. And the reason for, again, the conversation about having a background in science and technology is that we find these are better paying jobs, and they're better paying jobs that where there are opportunities in Eastern Connecticut. So there is a shift in trying to encourage young women to move in this direction, and it is working. It hasn't been moving as fast as we would like to see it, and therefore the current disparities that exist.
You mentioned that part of the state. We know that Electric Boat, manufacturers that are pairing up with the community colleges to get people with the right skills so that they can move into these jobs. I think it's 13,000 new manufacturing jobs in the next decade. Can you talk a little further, Chief Malerba, on what you guys are seeing on the ground to help connect women and girls to these professions?
Yes, and actually I think that there is a lot of activity in southeastern Connecticut. And when we think about Three Rivers Community College, they are working very closely with employers to determine what skill sets people are going to need and then looking at their curriculum to decide how best to meet that need. And I think that's really important because when we think about people who perhaps can't take a traditional route towards their education, starting out at a community college is really an excellent, excellent opportunity. And when we think about Dominion Nuclear Power Plant, they're reaching out to young students in high school, in particular at the tech schools, to encourage them to then study nuclear engineering, promising them a position once they're finished. And I have two great nieces that participated in that program and have been very gainfully employed by that industry. So it is a coalition that we need to create between the employers, the educational institutions, and trying to be creative in supporting even part-time education, because we don't want that to be a barrier. And we know that people have multiple priorities and multiple commitments. So we need to make sure that we're supporting education in a myriad way.
One of the report recommendations is developing women leaders. Both Miriam and Chief Malerba, both women leaders in your careers. Chief Malerba, what are some of your thoughts on how to encourage more young women into these leadership positions as someone who has had quite a career?
Well, it's funny, and I always tell our young tribal children, you don't understand how shy I was growing up, and that I really was very quiet. No one would have ever even known I was in the room. So what I encourage our young girls to do is to find their voice and to know that nothing can stand in their way if they just find some confidence. And I think success begets success. And I am a student who benefited from scholarship programs. I'm one of seven children. My parents were very loving. I had lots of support, but I knew that there wouldn't be financial support for my education. And so I took a very long, circuitous route and finally got my doctoral degree when I was 61. And always worked and went to school part-time. So my poor husband, long-suffering husband.
Well, this has been an interesting conversation. And before we go, I wanted to find out next steps from Mary Mullahy, again, President and CEO of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut. I understand there's a panel discussion coming up.
Yes, there is. I should mention that we have four women and girls funds, and we have invested over $1.7 million over the last 20 years or so on various initiatives that advance women and girls in our region. So part of our intent as we bring together policymakers, philanthropists, activists in the community is really to focus in on moving forward. So on March 8th, which is International Women's Day, we will have a gathering, and your guests on the air are all welcome to join us at the Norwich Inn from 3 to 5 to really dig deeper on how we can go about identifying solutions to some of the issues that we've found and raised, and how we can move together collaboratively to bring about change in our communities.
And we're going to link to that report again that we've been talking about, the status of women and girls in Eastern Connecticut, on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. We'll also tweet out a link. Thanks so much to Mary Mullahy, President and CEO of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut, also a member of the Board of Connecticut Public, and Chief Lynn Malerba of the Mohegan Tribe. She has a doctorate in nursing, also a trustee of the Community Foundation of Eastern Connecticut. Thank you both for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, an update from a series ProPublica has been working on, looking at maternal health and death in the U.S. ProPublica reporter Nina Martin is back to talk about her latest story on the role of midwives and what impact they have on the outcomes of mothers and their newborns. Did you have a midwife during your pregnancy? You can join the conversation. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In August, we talked to ProPublica about a startling statistic. The U.S. has the highest rate of maternal deaths in the developed world due to pregnancy-related complications. ProPublica's six-month investigation with NPR found that every day in America, on average, two or three women die from pregnancy-related causes, complications like preeclampsia, hemorrhage, and cardiac issues. And 60% of these deaths could have been prevented. ProPublica reporter Nina Martin is back with us today to talk about her latest reporting in the Lost Mothers series. Her story focuses on the role of midwives and the results seen from Europe to the U.S. when midwives have a bigger role in a woman's pregnancy care. Now, did you have a midwife during your pregnancy? How did that care continue after you had your baby? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome Nina Martin back to the show. Again, she covers gender and sexuality for ProPublica. Nina, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about this new study that looked at the rules surrounding midwifery, published in this peer-reviewed scientific journal, PLOS. I understand in a conversation with our producer, you described the study as groundbreaking. Why is that?
Well, this is the first time that researchers in the U.S. have been able to take a systematic look at what midwives can do, are allowed to do, and are not allowed to do in the states where they practice, and then overlay that with data from the CDC and from other federal agencies looking at a range of neonatal and indicators of neonatal and maternal health. So things like C-sections, infant mortality rate, the rates of breastfeeding, the rates of prematurity. So this is, it's the first time that researchers have been able to do this. And what they have found is, on some level, not very surprising if you happen to be a longtime advocate of midwives, or if you kind of understand the potential of what midwives can do in this country and what they do in abroad. And it basically found that in states that have the highest integration of midwives into their healthcare systems, they tend to do significantly better for on these measures of maternal and infant health. And states that have some of the most restrictive policies and laws towards midwives tend to do significantly worse on key indicators. It's important to note before we go much further that the study is not saying that the ways that states do on these rankings of infant and maternal health is directly related to midwives. They're saying that something that they're basically saying that that midwives that they don't do worse, and there are lots of other reasons that that infant and maternal health may or may not be doing well in an individual state, but midwives are potentially in states that don't have them a really important resource that we should be tapping.
When you're talking about other factors that can impact maternal health as well as the health of a baby, so chronic conditions, access to certain insurance or Medicaid in a particular state, these are access to preventative medicine, all the things that can factor into the outcome of a woman and her baby.
Exactly, and one of the things that that seems to be true is that states that have done the best toward integrating midwives relationships and sort of within the medical system, the overall medical system may be better integrated than states that have been the most restrictive towards midwives. So the states that have been the best, the most welcoming toward midwives include states like Washington, Oregon, and New Mexico. States that have done have been the most hostile to midwives are many of them are in the South, North Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, and then a couple of, and then some in the Midwest, Ohio comes to mind.
We should back up a little and explain to our listeners what exactly a midwife does. And depending on the state, as you mentioned, different laws, there's a different certification and licensing processes for midwives before they can become part of this this integration, this system for women as they go through their pregnancy and delivery.
Right. So a midwife is somebody who most of us think about as somebody who delivers babies or is involved in attending births. In the U.S., midwives attend around 10% of births in total every year. That doesn't mean that they deliver those babies. They are involved in their births in some way. However, midwives may or may not be trained to do much more. In the U.S., in every state, including Connecticut, there's a type of midwife that's the most common. That's a certified nurse midwife, and they are registered nurses who then have an additional graduate degree in midwifery. And they, within their scope of practice, as they describe it, includes everything from family planning to pregnancy care, prenatal care, postpartum care, childbirth, also menopause care, well women care. So that's the entire scope of practice for potentially for a certified nurse midwife. They are licensed in every state, and the rules by which they can be allowed to actually practice to their full scope of practice. That's one of the things that varies widely from state to state. There are other kinds of midwives that are generally known as direct entry midwives, and they usually don't have the same level of medical nursing training, medical training. One class is known as certified professional midwives. There's others called, quote, certified midwives or lay midwives. It's very confusing, as one of the as a number of people I talk to acknowledged. And the main thing about these midwives is that they have different levels of training, which isn't to say that their training is necessarily bad. It's just different. And they are much less likely to be licensed by states. And they are also often associated with out-of-hospital births, home births, or birthing center births.
On the phone with me is Nina Martin, who covers gender and sexuality for ProPublica. The latest story that she's done is looking at a study that rates and looks at the laws found in many different states about how a larger role for midwives could improve deficient U.S. care for mothers and babies. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Something you said, Nina, that I wanted to go back to in terms of in the United States, 10% of births are attended to by midwives. In Great Britain, you write that midwives deliver half of all babies, and then you go on to talk about some other European countries. Let's talk about the historical context surrounding when midwives were embraced in this country, and then what changed?
Well, midwives were embraced in this country, throughout much of the 19th century. Midwives delivered most babies in the U.S. as they did in every other country, as they have throughout human history. What happened in the 19th century is that in the late 19th century was this move toward the professionalization of medicine. And this was, in doctors' groups, the American Medical Association notably began pushing for a monopoly over all kinds of lay practitioners' care, and especially obstetrics care. One of the things that happened was that physicians, argued that midwives were that birth was a process that required scientific knowledge and hospital equipment, that it was a quote unquote pathologic process, meaning that bad things happened, as opposed to a physiological condition, which is what midwives argued then and now, which is that it's a natural function and doesn't necessarily require lots and lots of intervention for most normal pregnancies. The thing that overlaid the U.S. And that was different than in other in European countries is that by the late 19th century, early 20th century in this country, most midwives were either immigrants who brought, who spoke different languages, brought their own cultural ideas and practices, or they were black. In the South, these blacks were known commonly as granny midwives. And so there was definitely an element of racism and overlaid on sort of the medical objections that that doctors had. And so that's one of the things that was that really is different from in the U.S. There were parts of the U.S. Where midwives continued to be in use more than in other parts. So they were largely wiped out in the East and in the and in the South. In places in the West, Washington State, for example, which rates at the top of integration, New Mexico is similar. Midwives didn't entirely go away. Those were very rural states. They were very, they were much less. There were fewer hospitals, there were fewer options for women there in terms of doctors, and so midwives were always considered to be essential, and they were always better, they remain better integrated than in the East and the South.
Again, Nina Martin's on the phone with us from ProPublica. Again, we look at the difference in laws throughout the U.S. in terms of how midwives are able to care for women and their babies. Caroline's calling from Winsted, and you can join the conversation too, 860-275-7266. Caroline, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had three babies in my time, and one was with a traditional hospital birth and with a doctor or OBGYN. And the other two were, I decided to switch to a certified nurse midwife. And I cannot tell you the difference in the care that I got with the midwives. It was a whole body approach to my childbirth, to my pregnancy, and to postpartum care. It was just a wonderful experience. And what was amazing is their ability to really feel the baby when I was, when I was pregnant, to know exactly what was going on in my body, and to really address different issues I was having as a pregnant mom, whether it be edema or the protein count that was so important in terms of nutrition. And they really took time with me where, I felt with the OBGYNs, not that all would be this way, but mine in particular, really rushed me through my pregnancy. I didn't know what I was doing. It was my first pregnancy. So it was really wonderful to have the care of a midwife.
Thank you, Caroline, for your call. It's a good transition to my next question, Nina Martin, about how the midwifery model differs from that standard OBGYN care.
Well, you know, your caller touched on a lot of that. I would say what you hear often is that midwives are patient focused, they are community focused, much of what they do is focused on emphasizing close relationships between providers and patients over a period of time, so and a continuum of care. Think about what with many OBs, you see your OB many times during the course of your pregnancy, and then as soon as you give birth, you hardly ever see that person again. Maybe 6 weeks, maybe 4 weeks after you give birth, and that's it. But the continuum of care for a midwife, ideally, is all the way through the postpartum period, and visits often are much more frequent. Visits with midwives, I've heard from many women, tend to be much longer. OBs often spend, you know, just a few minutes. They rush in, they rush out. A midwife may spend a half an hour or more per visit. The major thing is it's about avoiding unnecessary interventions that can spiral into dangerous complications. So certain kinds of interventions are often necessary to make births safe for the mother and baby, but sometimes they're not quite as necessary as doctors and hospitals might make them seem. So induced induction of labor, for example, or giving somebody an epidural before she might be really feeling huge amounts of pain. Certainly C-sections are often, you know, it's many states, and Connecticut is a really good example of one that still has a pretty high rate of primary C-sections that are considered unnecessary. It's a little higher than the national average there, 34% over 32% for the U.S., and so these are the kinds of things that midwives are sort of striving to do. And this is, I want to say here, when we talk about maternal and infant outcomes in this country, the outcomes are particularly bad, as I've written, for African-American women. Infant death, much worse maternal deaths and maternal complications than for white women. And the model of one of the things that midwives are saying, especially in states that have large black populations in the South, and not very much OB care in general, because they're largely rural, many rural counties, that the midwifery model can really be something that that fills in gaps in care in those areas that disproportionately affect black women and rural women, and that the midwifery model, because it's very patient focused and patient friendly, and could even maybe cut through a lot of the kinds of unhappy interactions bordering on discrimination or not bordering, that actually do reflect systemic discrimination against African-American women that contribute to their bad outcomes.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm talking with ProPublica reporter Nina Martin about her latest story on midwives in the U.S. and the health outcomes that could be seen when midwives are part of a collaborative approach to prenatal and postpartum care. Now, how does Connecticut compare to other states on accessibility to midwives? The medical director of the Vadon Birth Center at Yale New Haven St. Raphael's campus will join us after the break, and we'll take your calls and questions too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been talking about the latest story in the ProPublica series, Lost Mothers. Reporter Nina Martin is with us. She reported on a recent study that found when midwives are given a larger role in prenatal and postpartum care in the U.S., there are better outcomes for mothers and their babies. The Vadon Birth Center at Yale New Haven Hospital, St. Raphael, introduced a midwifery model of care a few years ago. Right now, I want to ask Dr. Jessica Aluzzi to join the conversation. She is the center's medical director. Dr. Aluzzi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I mentioned you're an OB at the Yale New Haven St. Raphael. You were a force behind creating this center at the hospital birth center with midwives. Explain your rationale on why you were pushing this model of care at this particular hospital.
Well, Yale New Haven Hospital has a long history of having midwives integrated into the model of care that they provide, and that's largely due to the presence of the Yale School of Nursing and its teaching program in midwifery that's very well respected across the country. So many of the physician practices, as well as the hospital itself, has been integrating midwives into its program and offerings for many decades. So I did my residency at this hospital, so I trained amongst midwives, and I also kind of grew up around a mother who was a childbirth educator and a doula in one of the randomized trials in this country. So I was exposed to midwifery at a very early age. So I kind of have always respected this model and knew that it was something that was very important to provide high quality care to women. So this was an opportunity when these two hospitals merged, mm-hmm. I think, to really make sure that this model was something that was offered at this campus, knowing that it was already provided at the other campus. We wanted to make sure that it was definitely something that women could take advantage of.
And how receptive were your doctor colleagues to this midwifery model? We had talked earlier with Nina Martin about the history of midwives in the U.S., and I'm just curious if there was any pushback or just patients not quite understanding the role of a midwife and being hesitant about that.
Yeah, so like I mentioned, I think that New Haven is very unique because of the School of Midwifery in this city. Around Connecticut, it's not necessarily the same. I think that many physicians have trained in places where there were not midwives on the labor floors where they learned how to practice OBGYN, and instead their exposure to midwifery may have been to patients that were brought in from outside who were experiencing complications because while they were being cared for by midwives. So if that's their only exposure to a woman who's experiencing a complication, they develop a very negative view of midwifery. In contrast, if you're training in a place where there's many midwives on the labor floor that you're working on and you're actually developing very positive relationships with these providers and also seeing the very positive outcomes that they have and seeing women very satisfied and having excellent birth experiences, you have a very different perception of midwives and you're much more willing to work with them. So many of the physicians in New Haven, have that experience, and then many of the physicians on my team were fortunate to have had training like that. So I think you see a large dichotomy of physician experience across the country, and that might be why some states really are not so amenable to working with midwives and others are, and it kind of depends on the saturation of midwives in the areas where physicians have trained.
Nina Martin from ProPublica, what do you think about that the idea of competition being one of the barriers that in some states where you don't see as many midwives that are allowed to collaborate in this practice?
Well, I think that certainly competition is an issue in some states. I don't know to what extent it's an issue in Connecticut, but I think that's actually spot on. I think that in many states, I've heard over and over again that one of the big problems with doctors and patients as well is that they are just not exposed to midwives. In some states, and Alabama comes to mind, midwives are still sort of associated with granny midwives, and so unlicensed and, you know, people who don't know what they're doing. And that's kind of the pervasive attitude, apparently, even midwives tell me. And so without that kind of without sort of a density of midwives, without more people there showing, you know, kind of showing what they can do, there's going to inevitably be restrictions on what they can do, and a sort of a suspicion and hostility, or at least a skepticism and resistance toward them. I think that that is, makes total sense. I think North Carolina, I've heard, is actually a state. It's the worst. It was the least integrated. So of the states, and it ranked at the rock bottom. But actually, North Carolina has many more midwives than Alabama does, and many more midwife attended births. But there are just enormous restrictions on what the ability of midwives to actually practice, deliver the kind of care that they're capable of delivering and that they're trained to deliver as nurse midwives in that state. And that's what, and that's where the problems are. They need a doctor's permission to be able to practice at all.
I want to go back to Dr. Jessica Aluzzi. We just have a couple of minutes left. She's medical director of obstetrics at the Vadone Birth Center at Yale New Haven Hospital, St. Raphael campus. Nina's story also showed that in Great Britain, midwives deliver half of all babies there. I'm just curious, Dr. Aluzzi, you know, what do you think needs to change to see midwives, certified nurse midwives, be able to assist in this kind of care and at times even take the lead?
You know, that's an interesting question. So at our center, the midwives deliver all of the women who are having normal labors. Sometimes they have an OB resident with them, and sometimes they have a midwifery student with them. And then the obstetricians are there to perform cesarean deliveries or vacuum or forceps deliveries if necessary, and also there to help if a woman develops preeclampsia or has gestational diabetes or develops a hemorrhage. We're there to help with any complications that arise. But the other thing we're there for is to help when a labor is slowing down, or if the fetal heart rate tracing, if a woman's requiring continuous fetal monitoring, if the tracing is looking a little concerning, we're there by the midwife's side to help decide whether or not it's okay to keep going. And we've actually become team players in that effort. And I feel like that's giving the physician a role in helping women achieve a normal physiologic birth. And that's what I think is a truly collaborative role between a physician and a midwife. I think a lot of people talk about the midwifery-led model of care, and I think that's wonderful, but it actually shuts out physicians, and that actually will create this sense of competition and make physicians concerned that they're being replaced. And so if you come out into a state saying we're going to add a midwifery-led model of care, I think many physicians automatically may start to push back. But if you come into a state or a hospital and say, we would like to promote a collaborative model of care, and truly describe what that means, because it doesn't mean that the physician gets to step in and say, okay, we've labored enough, it's time to do a C-section. It actually means that the midwife and the physician are working together to help that woman achieve the birth that she wants to achieve, you know, and working together with the patient, with the woman in the middle, and the nurse and the midwife and the doctor, surrounding her with support, maybe with her doula and her partner as well, surrounding her with the support she needs to achieve the birth that she's trying to achieve. When we all do that together, and we can all celebrate in the success of a vaginal delivery, we as the physicians feel valued. So even if we have a vaginal delivery and we didn't deliver the patient in the end, we still feel like we were part of that success.
I wanted to just step in, Dr. Aluzzi.
Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to go back to Nina Martin. You know, something that we should point out in your story, half of all counties in the U.S. don't have a practicing OBGYN. So there is a room for this midwifery model in some parts of the country.
Absolutely. And the rural areas, and especially in the Midwest and the South, many counties don't have OBGYNs. They don't have hospitals that provide obstetric care. And midwives, trained, licensed midwives who are fully integrated into the system can really be an important resource.
And we'll have to leave it there. Nina Martin from ProPublica and Dr. Jessica Aluzzi from Yale New Haven St. Raphael. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Thanks for listening.